Welcome back. In our lectures so far, we've set out the groundwork for an investigation into ways in which Greek and Roman history displayed similarities and differences. In the next two lectures, we're going to focus upon the increasing political integration or engagement of the two peoples, though we must not ignore the fact that there are cultural and other forms of integration that are taking place simultaneously, which we'll be looking at later in our course. In this lecture, we're going to cover a period of nearly 500 years, from 750 BC to 272 BC. That's to say, from the traditional date of the foundation of Rome to the year in which the Greeks living in southern Italy and Sicily became subject to Rome. And throughout that period, the Greeks and the Romans were becoming increasingly aware of each other, even though somewhat distantly, as well as increasingly drawn into each other's world. Already in the 8th century BC, as we shall see in a moment, they were virtually living side by side with one another on the Italian peninsula. But I want to go back 800 years even before that, because a Greek-speaking people was in fact in Italy nearly 1,000 years before the foundation of Rome, as early as 1600 BC. The Greeks in question were the Mycenaeans, a people who flourished on the Greek mainland in the late Bronze Age, that's to say from roughly 1600 to 1100 BC, though their civilization was already beginning to decline by the late 13th century. The Mycenaeans are so called because their most important city, Mycenae, was located in the Argolid in the northeast Peloponnese. Their world extended over both the eastern and the western Mediterranean. Looking eastwards, it was the Mycenaean Greeks who laid siege to Troy, assuming, that is, that the Trojan War was indeed a historical event. And looking westwards, they established trading posts at Taranto, in the instep of Italy, that's to say between the heel and the toe, and at Syracuse in southeast Sicily and elsewhere. The Mycenaeans established trading posts at these places because they wanted metal ores. And when Mycenaean civilization began to collapse around 1200 BC, for reasons that are still disputed, we have no idea why that civilization collapsed, these outposts disappeared. A period known as the Dark Age followed, which lasted about 400 years. And when Greek civilization began to recover, a new era of exploration got underway. A number of communities started sending out what are often somewhat inaccurately called colonists. Among the first to do so were the Euboeans, that is, the inhabitants of the island of Euboea that lies off the east coast of Greece, just above Attica. The Euboeans first settled at Pithecusi on the island of Ischia, the largest island in the Bay of Naples, around 750 BC. Pithecusi was, in fact, the most northerly Greek foundation to be established in the West. And there's a lot of discussion among scholars as to whether to identify it strictly as a trading post, what the Greeks called an emporion, or as an apoikia, what we would call, somewhat misleadingly as I say, a colony. A home away from home is the literal translation. Pithecusi flourished in the second half of the 8th century BC, but began to decline around 700 BC, which means that its heyday was rather brief. One of the graves at the site has yielded a very famous clay vessel known as Nestor's Cup. It gets its name from an inscription that is scratched on its side, and it's one of the earliest examples of writing in the Greek alphabet to have survived. The pot is thought to have been manufactured in Rhodes, which gives us further insight into the truly Mediterranean nature of Greek culture and Greek trading exchange in this period. In 740, the Euboeans then founded the first Greek colony on the Italian mainland, called Cumae. Cumae lay about 10 miles north of Naples in Campania, that's the region of west central Italy. It possessed numerous harbours, well-watered plains and rich mineral deposits. Kumai dominated the coastal region of Campania for over 200 years. And another important Greek colony, more famous to us to this day, was Neapolis, modern Naples, meaning literally new city, which was founded in 600 BC. Though the Etruscans traded with the Greeks in Etruria, as we saw in an earlier lecture, there were no Greek colonists north of Campania. Many other Greek settlements were founded along the southern coast of Italy and in Sicily, the last being Heraclea in the instep of Italy to the west of Taranto in 433 BC. The concentration of settlements was so dense that the entire region of southern Italy came to be called Megale Hellas, meaning Great Greece. And then later, when the Romans encountered the Greeks, it was called Magna Graecia. The Greek colonies of southern Italy and Sicily too achieved considerable material prosperity and a very high level of cultural achievement. In terms of wealth, the Sicilian Greeks were the Americans of the Mediterranean at this time, and they used their wealth in part to build temples. Acragas, for instance, modern Agrigento on the southern coast of Sicily, boasts a remarkable series of temples that are among the most impressive and the best preserved of any in the Greek world. So, in the 8th century BC, we have Romans in Rome and Greeks in Campania, southern Italy, and Sicily. But when did the earliest direct contact take place between these two peoples? Rome's racial memory of her earliest contact with the Greeks derives from a story about a Corinthian by the name of Demaratus. Now, Demaratus was an aristocrat who fled to Italy around the middle of the 7th century BC, accompanied by a number of craftsmen fleeing from internal unrest in Corinth. He and his companions settled at Tarquinii, which was an important Etruscan city, to the north of Rome. And it's now that we see the Etruscans being a filter for Greek culture reaching Rome. In due course, the Corinthian craftsmen began teaching the Etruscans the art of molding clay. And what do you do with molded clay? Well, for one thing, you make roof tiles with it, which means you don't have to settle for straw and wood, which means you can make permanent buildings, a huge technological leap of considerable significance. But that's not all. According to legend, Demaratus had a son called Lucumo, and Lucumo became Lucius Tarquinius Priscus, Tarquin the Elder, the fifth king of Rome, who traditionally reigned from 616 to 579 BC. As I said, that's all according to legend. And why believe the oral memory handed down from one generation to the next of Corinthians teaching Etruscans the art of molding clay? Well, here's where it becomes really interesting and where archaeology today has taken us in the last few years to this point. Because excavations at Tarquinii have confirmed that from about 600 BC onwards, possibly even earlier, Greeks and Etruscans were living alongside one another. And second, it just so happens that the earliest roof tiles in the Greco-Roman world are associated with the Temple of Apollo at Corinth, the hometown of Demaratus, and they're dated to about 680 to 660 BC. And third, this is the most recent piece of the puzzle, huge clay beds. Beds, that is, from which clay was extracted for making roof tiles, dating to the last quarter of the 7th century BC, have recently been found close to the Roman Forum, some 40 feet below the present street level, which suggests that the Romans have by now learnt the art from the Etruscans. So, modern archaeology backs up the oral report that the Romans preserved of their cultural and technological dependency on the Greeks. The legend also speaks of a culture that was extraordinarily receptive to outsiders, so much so that it couldn't conceive of awarding the highest position in the land, that of being the king, to the son of an immigrant refugee. And it also demonstrates the importance of Corinth in the eyes of the Romans. How could the Romans pay Corinth a bigger compliment than by claiming that one of their citizens became king of Rome? And this is important because we'll see in a later lecture the fate of Corinth, which was destroyed by the Romans. There's another legend that the Romans preserved of their dependency upon the Greeks. We're told that the Sibylline books, books of prophecy, that is, compiled by the Greeks, were introduced into Rome in the time of Tarquinius Superbus, Tarquinius the Proud, the seventh and last king of Rome, towards the end of the 6th century BC, around 510, let's say. Although the date is almost certainly too early for their introduction, we do hear of the Romans consulting the Sibylline books in the 5th and 4th and subsequent centuries. Passing now from legend backed up by archaeology to literary history, the earliest recorded contact between the Greeks and the Romans dates to the second half of the 4th century BC, when the Romans had dealings with Alexander I, king of Epirus, the brother-in-law of Alexander the Great. Epirus was an area of northwest Greece separated from Italy by the Adriatic Sea. Alexander I crossed the Adriatic over to Italy in 333 BC, in other words, just a couple of years after Alexander the Great headed off east. And that's interesting because it suggests that there was an expansionist tendency in Greek culture at this time, not simply limited to Macedon, not simply going east, but perhaps also going west. Alexander I crossed over at the invitation of the Greek city of Tarentum, which wanted help against its neighbours. Greek Taras, modern Tarento, was the most powerful of the Greek cities in Magna Graecia. Alexander seems to have achieved some success. He's said to have negotiated a treaty with the Romans, though he was murdered before it was put into effect. The Romans, then, were certainly aware of what was going on in southern Italy by the 330s BC, though it probably didn't concern them a whole lot. And that's because they were heavily involved in gaining control of northern Italy at the time. Just to give you a brief rundown of Roman history in the early period. In 510, as we saw, Rome expelled her kings and established the Republic, the Res Publica. For 200 years after that, Rome was engaged in various life and death struggles on the Italian peninsula. Etruscan power, one of their rivals, began to decline soon after 500 BC, but it wasn't laid to rest until 396 BC, when, after a 10-year siege, the Romans captured Veii, one of the most important Etruscan cities. But soon after that, they had to deal with invasions from the Gauls, who had settled in the Po Valley to the north, and who were making raids across the Apennine Mountains. The Gauls inflicted a very severe defeat on the Romans at a stream called the Allia, about 10 miles north of Rome, in 390, and they followed that up by sacking Rome. However, they had no interest in settling in the area, and so they moved back to the Po Valley, and Rome recovered. It was only after they had defeated the Samnites, however, a people who controlled central southern Italy, due east of Rome, that Roman power became virtually unchallenged all the way across the Apennines to the Adriatic. And it was after their defeat of the Samnites that the Romans first got drawn into the politics of Magna Graecia, even though the Greeks had not previously involved themselves in Roman affairs. Now, however, the cities of Magna Graecia began to look upon Rome as their protector. They'd all been weakened by decades of what the Greeks did so well, internecine strife, but also in dealing with attacks from hostile neighbours. The Greeks had probably come into contact with the Romans during the Samnite Wars, since some of the hostilities took place in southern Italy. So they knew that the Romans were a military force to be reckoned with. In the 280s, the Lucanians, an Italic tribe that inhabited southwest Italy, attacked the town of Thurii in the Tarentine Gulf, in the instep of Italy. Thurii, in turn, appealed to the Romans for help, and the Romans responded and liberated Thurii from a siege. This, however, did not please the Tarentines, who had long been suspicious of Rome's growing power in the region. Thurii and Tarentum were both Greek, so we see there was no more solidarity among the Greek cities of southern Italy than there was among the Greek states of mainland Greece. When some Roman ships made an unexpected appearance in the harbour at Tarentum, the Tarentines sank four of them. And there's also a story that they pelted a Roman ambassador with mud. He replied, rather melodramatically, that his toga would be washed white in Tarentine blood. So, war was declared. The Romans began to get the upper hand, and then the next stage in the saga began. The Tarentines appealed to King Pyrrhus of Epirus, and this was just the opportunity that that king had been waiting for. Pyrrhus liked to think of himself as a latter-day Alexander the Great. He was, in fact, distantly related to him, and he had very big dreams. We should imagine him perhaps lying awake at night, fantasizing about building a vast empire in the west, just as Alexander had done in the east. So when he answered the call of the Tarentines, he was, he proclaimed, leading a pan-Hellenic or all-Greek campaign against a barbarian oppressor, which was exactly what Alexander the Great had claimed to be doing when he invaded Persia. Freedom, Eleutheria, and self-determination, Autonomia, for Tarentum and all the Greek cities in southern Italy were his watchwords. And incidentally, these were the words that the Greeks evoked every time they undertook a struggle, no matter what the provocation for it. Pyrrhus arrived in Italy with a force consisting of 25,000 men and 25 elephants. At Heraclea, in 280 BC, he won a notable victory. It was the first time, incidentally, that the Romans had faced elephants. 7,000 Romans fell, 1,800 were taken prisoner. However, Pyrrhus's losses were also extremely heavy, some 4,000 in all. And they were so heavy that he is said to have commented, "If we win one more battle against the Romans, we shall be completely ruined." And that's where the modern phrase, a Pyrrhic victory, comes from, meaning a victory that is so costly that it almost amounts to a defeat. Pyrrhus then offered terms to the Romans. The story goes that the Senate was seriously considering his proposal when a blind senator called Appius Claudius Caecus — Caecus actually means blind, the same Roman, by the way, who was responsible for the Via Appia that we talked about in a previous lecture — he was led into the chamber by his sons and said, "I was grieved by the loss of my sight. Now I lament the fact that I didn't lose my hearing as well. I never expected to hear such deliberations. You dare to call this peace instead of servitude?" The anecdote may well be an invention of a familiar sort, doughty Romans standing firm in the face of crisis. Anyhow, it's a fact that the Senate rejected Pyrrhus's terms and voted to continue the war. Pyrrhus marched north and fought the Romans at Ausculum in southern Italy in 279 BC, and again he was victorious, and again his losses were extremely heavy. Romans, 6,000 men lost, Pyrrhus, 3,500. He then received a call for assistance from Syracuse, the most powerful Greek city in Sicily. At the time, Syracuse was waging war against Carthage, whose aim was to bring all of Sicily under her control. I'll be talking about Carthage later, but it's worth mentioning briefly now, because along with the Gauls, Carthage was Rome's worst nightmare. The city was situated on the North African coast, not far from modern Tunis, and was the head of a loosely organized empire, which included Tripolis, the coast of Numidia, Mauritania, western part of Sicily, part of Spain. In some ways, her empire resembled that of Athens in the 5th century BC, in that it was based around the Mediterranean coast and depended on control of the sea lanes. And as we'll see later, the Mediterranean was not large enough to support two powers with maritime interests. Anyhow, Pyrrhus, no doubt tempted by the opportunity to present himself as the liberator of the Sicilian Greeks as well, answered the Syracusan call. But this time, he'd bitten off far more than he could chew. Rome and Carthage formed an alliance against him, which is ironic in view of the fact that they would be at each other's throats barely a decade later. To complicate matters for Pyrrhus, a Syracusan faction teamed up with the Carthaginians. So he was forced to return to Italy, and while he was attempting to move north against Rome once again, he was defeated at Beneventum, about 130 miles south of the capital, in 275 BC. This time, the Romans managed to frighten his elephants, which turned tail, stampeded, and crushed Pyrrhus' troops. The king abandoned his campaign and returned to Greece. Never again would a Greek threaten the Roman mainland. I've covered the war in some detail because it tells us a great deal about the Greeks and the Romans and about how they conducted themselves in war. Firstly, the Greek rallying cry of liberty and self-determination, eleutheria and autonomia. No matter what the source of the conflict, that would always be their professed aim, bogus much of the time, but potent as a rallying call nonetheless. Second, the internal squabbling, such as we saw among the population in Syracuse. The situation, incidentally, was much the same in Tarentum. Oligarchs versus democrats. Neither side could ever bury the hatchet, and they were always ready to bring in foreigners for their own narrow self-interest. Early on in their history, the Romans faced conflict between two social orders, the patricians and the plebs. Only the patricians could become magistrates, the aristocrats, and sit in the Senate. However, in 287 BC, the plebeians achieved political equality, and thereafter the two sides were able to lay aside bickering once and for all for the interests of the common good. Third, the appeal to the past. The Greeks were very connected to what they saw as the great events in their history. So Pyrrhus promoted himself as the reincarnation, almost, of Alexander the Great. In fact, when Alexander attacked the Persian Empire, he had presented his campaign as a rerun of the Trojan War. Fourth, Roman ingenuity and political skill. They made an accurate read of Greek political struggles and they inserted themselves into the middle. And fifth, the sheer gutsy determination of the Romans. Pyrrhus could have overwhelmed Rome. The outcome of the struggle was by no means a foregone conclusion. He was no mean adversary, but Rome stood firm. In 272, Tarentum fell to Rome. The Romans didn't treat the Tarentines harshly, though they did place a garrison in the city. And in addition, they required Tarentum and other Greek colonies to supply a certain number of ships when called upon. Romans didn't actually possess a battle fleet at this time, so it was a prescient move, as the next threat would come from the Carthaginians, and the Carthaginians had a very powerful navy. And that was that, at least for the time being. The year 272 is highly significant. It marked the end of independence for the Greeks in Magna Graecia. Rome had now become the dominant power on the Italian peninsula, and the Greeks would have established themselves in cities along the coast. They had no alternative but to acknowledge that fact. Though they remained free to govern themselves, their foreign policy would henceforth be dictated to them by the Romans. And the year 272 also marked the end of all interference by the mainland Greeks in the affairs of Italy. The defeat of Pyrrhus created nothing short of a sensation throughout the Greek world. Rome had hitherto been a little-known republic. Greece, of course, was the older culture. But we needn't doubt that the Greeks, intelligent and curious as they were, must have become aware that there was something about the Romans that made them special. After the war, Ptolemy II Philadelphus, king of Egypt, sent an embassy to Rome, we're told, in order to cultivate an acquaintance, so to speak. And another sign of interest on the part of the Greeks is the fact that a Greek historian by the name of Timaeus now starts writing about Rome. Before I talk about Timaeus, however, I want to back up. The earliest mention of Rome in any Greek text is to be found in the work of a 5th century logographer called Hellenicus, who refers to Aeneas as Rome's founder. About a century and a half later, the philosopher Aristotle recounts as a possibility the story that the Greeks who fought under Agamemnon at Troy, being driven off course by a storm on their way back home, founded a settlement in Latium. According to this version, therefore, the Romans were descended from the Greeks. All in all, therefore, interest in Rome before the Pyrrhic War was pretty negligible. And even in the first half of the 2nd century BC, the Greek historian Polybius could state that most Greeks of his period knew little about the history of Rome. However, by defeating a Hellenistic potentate, which is what Pyrrhus was, the Romans had now demonstrated, one, that their power in the Italian peninsula was unrivaled, and two, they were a force to be reckoned with in the Western Mediterranean. And it is around this time, too, as I said, that the Romans first aroused the interest of a Greek historian, Timaeus, who came from Tauromenion, modern Tauromena, on the east coast of Sicily. Timaeus lived from about 350 to 260 BC and was the author of a historical account of Sicily in 38 books, which included considerable information about Rome. Timaeus was primarily writing for Greeks who had recently come into contact with Romans. Greeks, that is, who were curious as to how Rome had become such an important regional power. Since only fragments of his account have survived, we don't know how he depicted the Romans, whether he was biased against them or neutral or whatever. We shouldn't exaggerate Timaeus' importance, however. Rome was still a fairly distant blip on the horizon of most Greeks, and it would be quite wrong to assume that in the middle of the 3rd century BC, the Greeks had any inkling of the fact that she was now poised to become a world power. After Timaeus, the next historian of note writing about Rome was Quintus Fabius Pictor, who flourished in the late 3rd century BC. Fabius Pictor was a Roman, not a Greek, a Roman senator, in fact. And he has the claim to being the first Roman historian. He wrote a history of Rome which went down as far as the Second Punic War, the war against Hannibal. And he wrote it not in Latin, but in Greek. He did this, A, for stylistic reasons, the Latin language was still in its infancy as a literary vehicle at this date, and B, for political reasons, in order to justify and explain Rome's foreign policy to the Greek world. In other words, he was writing primarily for Greeks and only secondarily for Romans who could speak Greek. After Fabius, Roman historians continued to write in Greek at least for another two generations. The first Roman to write a history in Latin was Cato the Elder, Cato the Censor, he's sometimes known as, 234 to 149 BC, whose work, the Origines, the Origins, nonetheless, showed the influence of his Greek historical predecessors. We've now reached the point where it's appropriate to talk in general terms about what is known as the Hellenistic period, since it was the period when Greek culture first began to get a firm hold over the Romans. The Hellenistic period begins with the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC, when the various parts of the empire which he founded came under the political and cultural dominance of his successors, as they are called. It ends in 30 BC when Egypt, the last kingdom under Greek rule, the last of the Hellenistic kingdoms, fell to the Romans. Hellenistic means something like Greekified. It derives from the name which the Greeks gave themselves in antiquity and which they still give themselves today, Hellenes, the inhabitants of Hellas. Incidentally, the Romans always called the Greeks the Graeci, and that's the name that has passed into our language and many other languages as Greek. Graeci was the name of a tribe that lived in Epirus in northwestern Greece, and the inhabitants of Epirus were among the first Greeks with whom the Romans had contact, as we've just seen. And eventually, the Romans applied the term Graeci to mean all Greeks. But back to the word Hellenistic. Hellenistic, in the sense of Hellenistic age, suggests a one-way street, the incredibly inventive and creative Greeks bestowing their cultural riches on benighted foreigners who had nothing to offer in return. We should be extremely wary of thinking that cultural interchanges are ever that simple, even though the Greeks themselves would certainly like us moderns to see them in that role. The Greeks always thought that their culture was second to none, and we have to avoid falling into the trap of believing. If we do, we won't do justice to the Romans. It was a far more complex pattern of interaction, and complexity lies at the very heart of our course. Greek influence on Rome is hard to pinpoint in the 3rd century BC, but it's evident in the Hellenistic period that Greek culture, that is, had begun to infiltrate the upper echelons of Roman society, because we find Roman consuls with Greek-style cognomina, surname, so to speak, that were attached to prominent individuals or families to denote some distinguishing characteristic. In this case, an association with Greek culture, as in names like Philippus, horse lover, Philos, lover, Sophos, wise, and so forth. Even so, we shouldn't suppose that the Greeks and the Romans had any profound understanding of one another at this date. In the next lecture, we're going to see the two peoples beginning a much closer relationship, one that would endure for the better part of a millennium.